Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As Americans reckon with our racial past and present, Confederate monuments and statues continue to be a key part of the discussions taking place over our history and how it's depicted. As Confederate statues and memorials come down in many places around the South, over 700 remain on public land, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And as NPR's John Burnett reported today, since George Floyd's death, officials in 28 communities have decided to keep their monuments in place. My guest today stumbled on one memorial that was being erected in 2015 as he was attending the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama. There, neo-Confederates were preparing for the re-erecting of a statue to Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest, a slave trader prior to the war and the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan afterwards. The first statue was erected in 2000 following the election of Selma's first black mayor, but was later stolen. This launched Connor Towns O'Neill's investigation. Defenders of these monuments say they were erected to honor war dead in the generation after the Civil War. Opponents say they were erected after Reconstruction as a symbol of white authority. But in the case of the four statues, most were erected well into the 20th century. O'Neill's book is titled Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. O'Neill is a producer on NPR's podcast White Lies and teaches at Auburn University and the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Connor Towns O'Neill, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Rich.
As Americans continue to grapple with this reckoning on race, one wall, huge wall in the dialogue, at least in the South, at least in my experience, has been the conflict over Confederate monuments. You know, just if you're on one side or the other, there's no talking about dialogue. In your view, why are these monuments so sacrosanct to their defenders?
They're sacrosanct to their defenders because I think they represent a view of history that is comforting and that honors the things that they want to remember and allows them to attempt to forget the things that they don't want to remember. And by that, I mean the legacy of slavery that the Confederacy was explicitly fighting to maintain and expand during the 1860s.
You talk about, I believe it is a relative of a Mary Todd Lincoln. Her name was Elodie. And she worked as, you say, she worked as a foot soldier for the Lost Cause, that campaign of revisionist history. And it was about emphasizing the valor of the average soldier, the tragedy of his death. They're able to sidestep the sort of thornier questions and actually just move that out of the equation.
That's right. Yeah, which is useful when you're trying to remember in public traitors to the United States. And that Lost Cause campaign that the members of the United Daughters of the Confederacy were a part of proved incredibly effective. I mean, their work on textbooks, public memory, our public symbols, really helped enshrine this view that the war was this tragedy of brother against brother, but, you know, the two sides had healed, and enslaved people were content, masters were benevolent. You know, this is a part of our history that we've moved past and can look back on fondly, which frankly is, you know, just doesn't square with the actual truth of what enslavement was. It was physical and spiritual torture. And through that system, so many instruments of capitalism were developed to enrich both the South and the North. So in so many different facets of American life, this is a legacy that we need to continue to reckon with. But that Lost Cause view of the war and its meaning and its consequences for us wants us to think that it's done and dusted.
I remember when I became interested in the Civil War when I was in elementary school, I was reading things about it, and my parents had several encyclopedia sets, and I remember going to one of those sets, and I unfortunately can't remember which one it was, but I went and looked under the Civil War, and it said, you know, I didn't see an entry, and then I went to the U.S. Civil War, didn't see an entry, and finally somewhere on one of those two entries it said, see war between the states. Which,
right,
in hindsight, seems so amazing that, wow, this was a very effective reframing of this whole conflict.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, just the other day, a friend of mine sent me some photos from her 10-year-old son's history textbook, which includes this story about Nathan Bedford Forrest, the general that I write about in this book, and, you know, some really minor campaign that he was a part of in northern Alabama. And it just goes to show the sort of length that encyclopedias, as you point out, or, you know, children's historical textbooks go to talk about this war in such a way that kind of lets us off the hook for the real tragedy and consequences of it, and instead view it as a military campaign, you know, between the states, and that we should think about it, you know, only in those terms. And that's really a shame.
I was really struck by something you said at the beginning, which is they were traitors to the United States. And I think the debate gets framed as one of two ways. Yes, they were secessionists and they were traitors to the United States. But in other terms, they were faithful to their state in defending their state. And it's this sort of, well, is it the United States or is it the state that you're, you know, that your honor and loyalty goes to?
Right. I think that's certainly an accurate representation of the other side of that. I guess to that, I think that's insufficient, though. And to that, I would add, you were defending your state's right or ability to do what exactly? To continue to enslave Black Americans and to, you know, enrich yourselves from it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that certainly thinking about it in terms of defending your state is one way to think about it, but I think it is insufficient. And to our previous, you know, to the previous question, it leaves out this other history that we'd rather not remember, or at least, you know, don't want to talk about publicly.
Well, we're still having difficulty in confronting this history. Your book goes to a long way to sort of destroying some of the, I think, shibboleths that surround this history of these events 150 years ago. It investigates the history and attitudes surrounding four statues, as you mentioned, of this particularly notorious Confederate general, Nathan Bedford Forrest. But it sounds like from your book that you sort of stumbled upon this story. Why did you decide to write about these four statues?
So, I stumbled onto this story really by accident. I was in Selma, Alabama for the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which is the attack by Alabama police officers on nonviolent protesters on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. The late John Lewis among them. And President Obama was there to mark the 50th anniversary. And, you know, wherever the president goes, Secret Service is there, 40,000 other people showed up. So Selma, which is a pretty small city, was suddenly sort of overrun. And so I'm combing through downtown looking for parking, not finding it. So I figure, all right, I know there's a cemetery over here, and it's one of those southern cemeteries with the roads and the Spanish moss on the magnolias, you know, one of these sort of midnight in the garden of good and evil places. So I pull in there thinking I'll find an out-of-the-way place to park. And what I come across is way more than I bargained for. I did find free parking, it turns out, but it was because I had met a group of neo-Confederates who called themselves the Friends of Forrest, who were there that day because they have a plot of land in the cemetery called Confederate Memorial Circle, and they were getting ready to put up a replacement statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest. One had been up and had been stolen, and they were getting ready to replace it. And so the dissonance, the sort of whiplash between being there, thinking about civil rights sacrifice and violence and, you know, the legacy of that day and the sort of powerful and tempting narrative to think, you know, that we've overcome, we have a Black president, that Black president is here, thinking about the day in terms of progress and optimism, totally got scrambled meeting this group of neo-Confederates. And so, you know, I grew up in the North. I didn't have a ton of history on the Civil War at that point. So, you know, I didn't know much about Forrest, but the strangeness, the dissonance of that encounter sent me down a rabbit hole about Forrest and his statues and what it meant to put up a statue of Forrest in 2015, who he was, what his legacy meant to the country. And it just seemed like a sort of oddity. It's something that I would, you know, maybe write an essay about. And then a couple months later, the Charleston 9 murders happened and a national referendum on Confederate symbolism, the flag, names of schools, monuments especially, really broke out. And so as that started to happen in the summer of 2015, I started to follow campaigns against Forrest monuments, in particular because of this encounter that I had. And like you say, the book tells four stories. In the story in Selma that I had come across, and that serves as a kind of prelude to these campaigns that broke out in the years since. So I write about a building on the campus of Middle Tennessee State University that's named after Forrest. And in the 2015-2016 school year, a group of students led a pretty impassioned campaign to get the school to change the name. I write about a statue in Nashville that I call the ugliest Confederate statue, which I think puts it in the running for ugliest monument writ large. But it is this obscene, sort of grotesque, almost it looks sort of animated plastic statue that's on the roadside of I-65. And I tell the story of the sculptor who founded the League of the South, which is a neo-Confederate secessionist group, a white nationalist group. Though the sculptor died in 2010, but the group that he co-founded went on to instigate a lot of the violence in Charlottesville in 2017. Mm-hmm. And then the statue of Forrest in Memphis, and the covering the campaign that was ultimately successful in removing that 30-foot bronze statue at the end of 2017. So it's four stories that really kind of move us through the last several years of Confederate monuments debates, but also a broader reckoning about race in this country. And I use the stories of these monuments to dig into those deeper questions.
What's interesting is we've had this reckoning on these Confederate monuments. Often defenders will say, you know, this is here not to honor necessarily the person who led the revolt against the United States. It's there to honor the war dead. But what's interesting, three of the four statues you write didn't go up during the generation right after the Civil War to honor war dead. And it sort of belies that argument from defenders. These went up, I think the conclusion you can reach is they went up as a symbol of white power in the 1960s, in the 1990s, in the 2000s, for that matter, as a direct result of things that had happened in which the equalities of the race became apparent to the defenders of these people that put up these statues.
Yeah, I think that's accurate to say. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center does a great job of doing data reporting on Confederate monuments, and they have a really revealing chart that shows that the two big spikes in Confederate symbols and Confederate monuments come at the turn of the 20th century and then again in the middle of the 20th century. So basically post-Reconstruction, after Confederates had returned to power, returned to impose white supremacy as the, you know, structuring force of these cities, states, region.
I think you could say. I think you could say it's consolidating the Supreme Court victory of Plessy versus Ferguson, which said separate but equal was the rule of law.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's a great marker for it. And so you see then in the years after that, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, a slew of monuments go up. Then again during the Civil Rights Movement. So broadly speaking, you know, zoomed out from 30,000 feet, they are these symbols of backlash, these symbols, as you say, of white power. The data is just irrefutable there. And then what was interesting, what I found in zooming in and looking specifically at these monuments of Forrest, is that they kind of provide the exceptions that prove the rule. So they're happening at moments outside of those two big spikes, but they're happening for the same reasons. When the city of Selma, a city that is synonymous with black voting rights, the city that gave the world the vote, as some people call it, when they elect the first black mayor in the town's history, the mayor who unseated the nine-term incumbent who had been the mayor during Bloody Sunday, James Perkins Jr., the first black mayor, is elected in 2000, and his first week in office, a statue of Forrest goes up. So yeah, it's that comes outside of those two big spikes that the Southern Poverty Law Center talks about, but for the same reason.
To me, it was amazing, this story of Selma. You know, your whole premise of the book, where you go to Selma on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, and you would think that, okay, everybody's on board of this, and you discover this monument that says, no, not everybody is on board with the Civil Rights March. In fact, they're active opposition, and they put up this statue when Selma gets their first black mayor. And it's eventually stolen by somebody. And then they go right back to put up another statue 15 years later.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one of the things that I've come to realize spending a lot of time reporting in Selma over the past couple of years is that I think in the sort of national imagination, Selma exists as sort of stereotype backwater southern town, the place that was the setting for the climax of the civil rights movement, and I think kind of exists almost in the way that Charlottesville has come to exist for us as a sort of stand-in for a place where there's a lot of racism. But what I've come to find in spending a lot of time in Selma and investigating a lot of moments in that city's history is that they're sort of 10 or 15 years ahead of the curve almost. That was true with school segregation, or how the schools resegregated, happening just a few years before a broader trend in the 90s would catch up to it. And that was certainly true in this debate about Confederate monuments that we've been having nationally for the last couple of years, Selma has been having for the last couple of decades. So I think it's a city that really kind of stages and reflects a lot of larger national anxieties or dilemmas.
Yeah. Selma, as you write in the book, says, you know, it dealt with these white flight, you know, for a small town, a relatively small town, it dealt with white flight in a way that you don't think of in small towns. People moved outside of the city and into the county where they could have white schools. So you're talking about putting up a monument in a city that is no longer 60-40 white-black. It's like 80-20.
Yeah, which is just further points up the motivations for the meaning of this statue and its intended audience.
Well, as interesting as the Selma story, I think even more tragic is the story of Murfreesboro at Middle Tennessee State. Mm-hmm. You have a group of students in the wake of all of these events saying, yes, let's get rid of this Forest Hall that has been there. Some of the symbols had been eradicated, and the statue there was again put up during the Civil Rights era, the 1960s. You had the students leading this movement to get rid of this statue, and yet it's almost like it was a classic town versus gown. Even though it was on the campus, the town weighed in on this statue in a major way.
That's right. They weighed in forcefully. It was an emotional story to report on, and especially taxing for the students who felt like the whole structure of the task force that the university had created to weigh this question of whether they should change the name of Forest Hall or not felt in bad faith to them. As one of the activists said to me, we don't think racism should be debated at this point. So the students went through a full academic year of protest and having to give voice to the ways that they felt insulted, demeaned by the fact that the school was honoring a slave trader, the first Grand Wizard of the Klan, an accused war criminal during the Civil War. You know, as one student testified during one of these forums that they hosted, I don't want to have to walk to 9 a.m. biology past a reminder that someone didn't think that I was human. So yeah, it was a challenging and draining campaign that these student activists led, compounded by the fact that even though people were pretty pessimistic on their chances of actually getting it changed, the school actually did that. Well, at first, the task force came to agree with them and recommended to the university president that the school should change the name. The university president took that recommendation, but he then had to recommend to the state board of regents that oversees the university that they should change the name. The board of regents took that recommendation, also agreed, okay, we should change this name. But because of the convoluted laws that exist in Tennessee that protect public military history, which is to say Confederate history,
right,
in that state, the last hurdle that they had to jump was the Tennessee Historical Commission that required a supermajority of that committee to approve the name change, and they did not approve. So Forest Hall remains Forest Hall.
Interesting. It's like the Tennessee Historical Commission is basically there to protect Confederate historical monuments in a way. I was really struck by one of the students that led the movement to change the name, Joshua Crutchfield. You, this is your assessment of his opinion, but I thought it was very telling. He said it seemed to him that students were working harder to better the school than the school was to better them, to educate them. They were having to educate the school. I thought that was a very telling quote from the book.
Yeah, and I think he's absolutely right in that assessment. And I think that's been true for the experience of students across the country. You know, in 2015, 2016, as the campaign at MTSU was taking place, it was really a moment. Students across the country were standing up and saying, you know, who these universities honor are just completely inconsistent, incompatible with the values of inclusion and diversity that you claim to hold, to say nothing of the toxic racial atmosphere that students talk about experiencing at these universities. I think the campaign at Middle Tennessee State has a lot to say, not just about how Forrest is remembered or misremembered, but also larger issues about inclusion at universities across America.
My guest today is Connor Towne O'Neill. He's a producer on the NPR podcast White Lies. He teaches at Auburn University, and he is the author of Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy, which he details the stories of four statues of the notorious Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest in the South, in Selma, Murfreesboro, and Nashville, Tennessee, and Memphis, Tennessee, and the actions surrounding those statues in the reckoning over race and Confederate monuments. Of course, Nathan Bedford Forrest was not only a Confederate general, but he was considered the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and he details that history as well. Well, let's skip over Nashville and talk about Memphis, because Memphis was a successful story, and it's part of that Take 'Em Down movement that came out in the wake of Charlottesville, and it also showed up in New Orleans and other southern cities where it was successful. Tell us about the success in Memphis. What happened there that allowed people to say, yes, we need to remove this statue?
Well, it was a long slog. The city had been trying to remove this statue of Forrest, which went up in 1905, so at the beginning of, you know, sort of Jim Crow era. It's this 30-foot bronze equestrian statue, very stately-looking. A sculptor from Paris was commissioned to do it. And the city had been trying to take it down since 2013. But again, the Tennessee Historical Commission that we talked about with MTSU has twice denied the city's applications to remove the statue in 2016 and then in 2017. So I think because of the grassroots movement from Take 'Em Down 901 and, you know, increasing political pressure and a rare consensus among city council and the county commission, they decided, you know, sort of Tennessee Historical Commission be damned, we're gonna take this statue down. So they found a loophole in the law. The law, as written, required cities to seek approval from this historical commission for any statue on public land. Well, it didn't say anything about private land. So the city sold the park in which this Forrest statue stood, as well as a park where a couple of other Confederate monuments stood. They sold the land to a county commissioner who had established a nonprofit. So they sell the parks. They're now on private land. And that very night that the parks were sold, Van Turner, this county commissioner, removes the statue of Forrest. And it is the scene in which that statue comes down is very striking. So it's night, it's December. There's this blue light from the flashing lights of the police cruisers. And this, you know, really enormous statue is lifted slowly off of its pedestal by a crane. And it's this, you know, hit with this blue light, and it's hanging there for a couple of moments, just swaying slightly. And when I talked to Van Turner, the commissioner who you know gave the order to remove this statue, he talked a lot about that weight and what that weight represented. You know, his father, who grew up in Memphis, it was illegal for him to go to that park while he was growing up because the park was segregated. He talked about the larger history of lynching in the South and the violence that this Confederate history represented. He talked about, as the crane picks up that statue, all of the symbolic weight that statue had held for so long was finally being lifted. And so it's this really stark moment, these striking images, but also this larger symbolic removal or lifting of the weight that happens there that I found incredibly moving.
One of the striking things surrounding the removal of these monuments has been the lack of common dialogue between people who want to see these monuments go as a relic of a racist past versus defenders of a certain way of life. It seems to me that moving forward, dialogue is critical to resolving some of these wounds. How do we get to a point where we can have that dialogue?
I think one of the factors that is important to consider there, and I think is especially pressing in the debate over Confederate monuments, is that Americans don't have a shared history, especially not the shared history of the Civil War. So I think one way in which we can begin to have that conversation that you're describing is to come to a common understanding of the past, of our Civil War history, why that war broke out, what the central question of the war was, and why that central question is still with us. And that question, I think, is can a country, a settler, slaver society, actually transform itself into a multiracial democracy? That was the question of the Civil War. That was the question of Reconstruction. That was the question of the civil rights movement. And I think that's a pressing question right now. And I think in order to answer it, we're going to have to come to a common sense of our history, of that slave society past, and how the story that we told ourselves to justify enslavement, that Black Americans were inherently inferior, and thus we could enslave them and extract their labor and profit from that labor. I think until we come to a common understanding of why the Civil War was necessary and the circumstances that surrounded it, I don't think we'll be able to have that conversation, because the Lost Cause point of view insists that there's nothing there to reckon. There's nothing there that's been unresolved, that it's all good. These were good people, worthy of being honored. There's no debt to be collected here. But you have Black Americans, people of color, saying, look, we continue to live with a racial hierarchy that impacts everything from our wealth, access to healthcare, access to education, so many ways in which we live in an unequal society. And so I think if we want to have a conversation about how to address that inequity, we're going to have to understand what our history means and what the Civil War in particular meant. So hopefully we can get there. That sounds like a tall order, I know.
But coming up with a shared history is first. Coming up with a shared history.
I think so. And that involves a sense that, like, it's okay that our history doesn't flatter us. I think that we have, a lot of us have, because we're taught to have a sense that because America is the greatest country in the world and because we love freedom and liberty, that somehow our past needs to be rosy, flattering to us, full of only the most upstanding people. And if they did make any mistakes, well, they got over them. And we're only a more perfect union now. I think if we can get over that sense that our history needs to flatter us, we stand a better shot at coming to a common understanding of what that past means and what we should do about it today.
Name of the book is Down Along With That Devil's Bones. Connor, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Rich.
Connor Towne O'Neill is a producer on the NPR podcast White Lies and the author of Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.